it's Canadian.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Joint Committee on Legislative Administration to order. I apologize for my voice. It's a little gravelly. Thank you for being here. We have two items today. We're going to start off with a presentation from the Oregon Law Commission, and then we'll have hearing and work session on some changes to personnel rules, and you should have all of that in OLIS for the committee. So thank you for being here. And with that, I'll open an informational meeting. Update on the Oregon Law Commission, Oregon State Capitol Workplace Harassment Work Group. I think we have someone from the commission. Yes. Thank you. You also have hard copies of the draft, and we'll hear why it's draft. So welcome. Thank you for joining us today, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Kotek, my name is PK Runkles Pearson. I'm the chair of the work group of the Oregon Law Commission that addressed your request regarding the personnel rules. Little bit about me. I'm a partner at the law firm of Miller Nash, Graham & Dunn. I specialize in employment, education, and constitutional law, making me an interesting fit for this work group. I'm a member of the Oregon Law Commission, appointed by Governor Brown. And as I mentioned, I'm the chair of the Capitol Workplace Harassment Work Group, which was convened in April in response to requests from Senator Courtney and Speaker Kotek. As you'll see before you, the work group has draft consensus recommendations and a draft report. The reason that they are draft is that our work schedule has not yet, we've not had our final meeting to approve these drafts. That last meeting was set before you had invited me here today. So next week, the work group will meet and consider approval of this report. And then following that, just a couple days after, the Law Commission itself will consider approval of the report. So today I'm speaking for myself as chair of the work group. And for my understanding of the current draft, but I'm not able to guarantee to you that these will be the final recommendations. Based on extensive discussion with the work group, I expect there to be very few, if any, changes to what's before you today. A little bit about the Oregon Law Commission. As you may know, it was established in 1997 for the purpose of conducting a continuous program of law reform. It's nonpartisan. It's what I'd like to refer to as super friends for law. There are representatives from all three branches of state government. There are trial and appellate judges, current and former legislators, the attorney general, and a gubernatorial appointee, myself, as well as representatives from the Oregon State Bar and Oregon's law schools. The work group in particular, I'd like to call out. I'm so grateful for their professionalism and dedication on this matter. Our work group was very diverse in both experience and expertise. It included employment lawyers representing employees and management, former legislators, Representative Vicky Berger and Representative Terry Beyer were on our group, as well as legislative staff, including Angela Wilhelms. Justice Jack Landau, who's retired from the Oregon Supreme Court, an academic from the University of Oregon who specializes in the field of implicit bias, and other professionals with extensive experience preventing and responding to harassment in professional and educational settings. As the chair of the work group, it was my privilege to sort of figure out who I would love to have on this group, and I'm pleased to say that every one of them said yes, and nothing made me happier than to spend a lot of time in a room with this really distinguished group of people. Not only is the group diverse in experience, but also diverse in how we experience the world. Our group was balanced in terms of gender, in terms of sexual orientation, in terms of age, and in terms of race, and probably many other characteristics that I don't know. We had very intense efforts at public involvement before we even began our process to try to figure out what exactly is going on here at the Capitol, what are the rules, how do things work, and what are concerns. We widely publicized the need for feedback. We provided avenues for anonymous feedback on our website, as well as for written testimony throughout. We took public testimony twice, once at the beginning of our process, and then once at the very end before finalizing the draft recommendations that are before you. And I will tell you, there were changes made in response to that public feedback, even at our very last meeting. One thing I think is very remarkable about our process is that every single draft recommendation was debated and disseminated in real time. After every work group meeting, we published yet another draft, and we continued working on that draft, and that draft was publicly available throughout, and we got helpful feedback throughout, so I think that process was useful. So what did we learn? We learned a lot about the culture here at the Capitol. As you know, it's very complex. Not only is it a workplace for legislators and for partisan and nonpartisan staff, it's also a place of public accommodation. And of course, as we all know, it's the heart of our democracy. So it's a very complex place. This is my personal view. I believe harassment is based on power. It starts with the power associated with privilege. And all workplaces, not just the Capitol, are based on power relationships. And this makes workplace harassment a very difficult problem to address. The power relationships, as you know, in the legislative environment are even more difficult. Not just this legislative environment, every legislative environment. They are more intense. They are more explicitly power-based. They are more complex in how that power bumps against each other. There are legislators, there are partisan and nonpartisan people, there are lobbyists, and there are members of the public. And depending on which meeting you are in, which moment you are in, those power relationships may be completely different. The power relationships in the Capitol are also more decentralized. Those sources of power are varied, and they are shifting. So that makes a legislative environment, not just this one, everyone, a very difficult problem for figuring out an appropriate workplace harassment scheme. Enhanced power relationships inherently make it difficult for anyone to make waves. And this includes victims of harassment, those who observe harassment, and those who are charged with addressing harassment. The testimony and the experience of the workgroup members described a culture in need of existing shared cultural understandings in this building have not yet evolved to create a place where everyone works together to create a welcoming environment for everyone every time. That's not to say that there aren't times where there is a very welcoming environment, but as in all of our society, it is not yet uniform. In addition to the complex facts of the workplace, there is a complex legal and policy overlay to addressing these problems, and we addressed many sources of law. I won't bore you with all the details of every piece of law. There are some in the memo before you. We talked about a lot more. We talked about employment policy, what is a best practice. We talked about state and federal employment laws that might govern. We talked about state laws of privilege, how one can keep things confidential in terms of a legal privilege. We talked about public records laws. We talked about state constitutional provisions that talk about legislative self-government. This is a particularly unique workplace in that it is allowed to self-govern under the Oregon Constitution. We talked about protecting the rights of constituents to be represented. We talked about state and federal constitutional civil rights and civil liberties, including free speech and due process, all of which require attention. And then we talked about the policy considerations. Our primary concerns were to ensure that harassment, if it is ongoing, stops, that a system that we recommend provides due process and a hearing for respondents, people who've been accused of sexual or racial or other harassment. And we were concerned, we talk about this every time, about preventing weaponization of complaints for political purposes, which is a particularly strong concern here in this environment. In every meeting, our work group wrestled with how to balance all of these issues. Every work group member had to look at every possible scenario from the standpoint of a complainant and the standpoint of a respondent, and every member realized that there are no perfect answers. One thing that astounds me that at the end of our process, assuming this is approved, our recommendations in all but one respect, which I will talk about, are completely unanimous. This blew me away, having such a diverse group of people in our room, so many different kinds of experiences. For example, my experience is in managing or representing management in employment cases, among other cases. Sitting right next to me at the table was a person who is usually across the table from me in pretty much every litigation, a plaintiff's lawyer. We agreed on every issue. People on both sides of the bipartisan divide agreed with every issue. Lobbyists and non-lobbyists agreed with every issue, except for one, which is minor and which I'll talk about. But in the vast consideration, that is absolutely astounding in my view. And what is the biggest takeaway that we came up with is that we can talk to you all day, and I could, but I won't, about all the different procedural mechanisms that we recommend in terms of policy and procedure. But as in any workplace, no policy and no procedure change will ever be effective until culture changes. So how do we change culture? And that is the biggest problem. We've come up with some recommendations on how to do that. The first is that we recommend that the legislature establish an equity office staffed with at least two people. This would be a dedicated, sustained presence in the building, working to train and advise, and where necessary, working to remediate problems of harassment. We recommend that this this group be independent and then report to a bipartisan committee. We recommend that the equity office work on training, and that training should be required for everyone in the building, not just legislators, not just partisan and bipartisan staff, also for lobbyists who are in the building and as much of a part of the culture as the rest of you are. We recommend that training not be the kind of training that we're all used to. I think we've all seen the training from the 1980s, which is on some sort of video, which has explanations of very clearly inappropriate things and then tells people not to do those things. The latest research and best practices on training have evolved beyond that. And in that, we were really influenced by a professor from the University of Oregon named Elizabeth Tippett, who has written a lot about this. She recommends, and others do as well, that training be talking about what to do as opposed to not what not to do. That it be training others in the environment to understand and see when harassing behavior is happening and teaching folks how to intervene to stop that. That training demonstrate the impact of harassment on real people rather than just saying that you should do it. And that training also address generational issues. There is a wide range of generations in this building, and as we know, what folks consider welcome or unwelcome changes over time and changes generationally. And particularly when you're dealing with folks like interns and people who are very new in their careers, their understanding of what is appropriate or not appropriate is very different. Doesn't mean that it's necessarily wrong, but harassment changes based on what's welcome or unwelcome, and it's important that we all have a shared understanding about what's appropriate and not appropriate. So we think training should address generational issues. We also recommend that the Equity Office have a process for having confidential process counseling and reporting. Now, we did encounter some difficulties legally with making things as confidential as we wanted them to be. We've outlined those things in the report. What we do believe that having a as confidential as possible place to go, if you are a person thinking about bringing a report, if you are a person thinking about whether this is an appropriate thing to report, if it is a concern that you have that you don't want your name splashed all over the front of the newspaper, that you have a place to go and that you have a place to report those things. And in the experience of our group members, many of whom have lots of experience in investigations, myself included, having a confidential avenue for reporting is going to increase reporting, and increasing reporting is what allows you to address a problem. So we recommend that process counseling be there, not just for folks who want to bring forward a complaint, also for folks who believe that they may have done something wrong or believe that they may eventually be the source of a complaint. We want everyone to understand what the rules are and to be able to ask questions about those. In order to make things as confidential as possible, we recommend that the legislature adopt an evidentiary privilege for this kind of reporting. There's a precedent for this. There's already an evidentiary privilege for reporting to victims' rights centers on university campuses. We think that there could be a way to expand that to include confidential reporting to the office that we recommend you adopt. We recommend that the legislature create a leadership team that is also permanent and is there for the purpose of continuing to address culture and to address these issues. We understand that there is an equity team that exists. That is a valuable effort, and we're very glad that that is there. What we believe needs to happen is that that leadership team needs to have more institutional support behind it and needs to have people who are in power working directly on it. The way you change culture is that you have people in power show that they want the environment to change, and being part of a committee like this is a big part of it. We also have specific recommendations about interns. We received a lot of concern from different folks about the vulnerability of people who are new in their careers. And we have specific information about how we believe interns should be reached out to. One thing we were surprised to learn is that there is no system in this building that is regularly used to keep track of who is in the building in terms of interns. That makes interns particularly vulnerable. It means that there are no particular onboarding processes for interns, and that interns who come in and out of the building quickly may or may not know about ways to report. We also recommend that the office establish relationships with university campuses where interns are most likely to come from so that there can be a smooth and seamless transition for those interns coming into the building. We also recommend that the equity office have regular culture surveys to try to figure out, is the training working? If it's not working, where is it not working? How can we make it change? This is a best practice that we're seeing in many avenues. We think it would be very valuable here in the Capitol as well. And that all of that I just talked about has nothing to do with slapping people for doing bad things. All of that is about changing culture so that harassment doesn't happen. We also recommend, of course, that we do need to have a mechanism for when harassment does happen. And we recommend that there be an investigative arm of this equity office, that it be separate from the group that takes confidential reports. So the person who receives confidential reports is also not the person who is conducting investigations. We recommend that there be at least one dedicated, available professional in the building to conduct investigations. Most investigations under our recommendation would stay in-house, but others, those that are particularly high profile or with an exaggerated power dynamic, probably any investigation involving a legislator would go outside. And we recommend that there be a well-vetted, small but not just one set of investigators who could be willing and prepared to conduct these investigations. We think it's important to keep the group small for a couple of reasons. One, it's important to vet the qualification of these investigators very well. Two, we also believe that over time there will be, if you will, for the lawyers on the group, sort of a common law of the policy that will develop, that people will learn what policies, how the policy has been interpreted before, and endeavor to interpret it consistently moving forward. So we believe keeping a small group of investigators is valuable. So that's the equity office. We also have some recommendations in terms of how to change the policies here to address harassment. We recommend a more robust definition of harassment and retaliation. We've included a sample in the documents in front of you. It's in appendix, I believe it's appendix A. We believe that there should be a more robust reporting process, a process that includes, as I mentioned, confidential reports, but also non-confidential reports. Non-confidential reports could come from two places. One would come from supervisors or people in positions of power who understand or have seen harassing behavior happen. Those would need to be reported. And then individuals who believe that their work environment has been adversely affected could also report. We believe that you should expand the coverage of your policy. The current Rule 27 only applies to legislators and legislative employees. We believe that there need to be more groups of people who can make complaints and more groups of people who can be respondents, whose behavior can be addressed under this policy. That includes lobbyists. That includes other members of the public who are in the building. That is a national trend. During our process, we spent a lot of time looking at what the U.S. Congress has done, what other state legislatures have done to address harassment, and trying to find some way to address harassment by or against anyone in the building is very important, and that's a big hole, we think, in the current policy. We also think that there should be a longer reporting period. The current Rule 27 only allows 1 year after a harassing event happens until a report can be made. This is the one place where our committee was non-unanimous. Everyone agreed 1 year is too short. A significant portion of the committee, I'll admit myself included, believes there should be no limit on when you report. And the basis for that is that this is akin to an employer's internal policy. When I counsel employers and managers every day, if there's someone who wants to come forward with evidence of harassment or retaliation or whatever it may be, I don't counsel that employer to turn the complaint away because it's been too long. I counsel the employer to do something about it. Now, what you can do may be different depending on how long it's been, who's still in the building, et cetera. But I found in my experience that even very old complaints sometimes can be evidence of someone who was a serial harasser or some explanation of things that could be changed for the better. The rest of the committee, not the rest of, probably another half of the committee, believed that there should be a significantly longer reporting period, and the period that they coalesced on was 4 years. So as you see, whether it's 4 years or no time limit, it's still a significant expansion from what the policy currently requires. The folks who believed that there should be a 4 year limitations period were focused on the reputational harm to individuals who are accused of harassment. And there, it is true that when you look at statutes of limitation in criminal law or in civil law, non-policy areas, you find that there are limitations periods, and the purpose of that is because evidence fades over time, and it can be more difficult to defend oneself if you have a complaint that there's no evidence for anymore. But either way, whether you're looking at 4 years or no time limit, that's still a significant expansion from what the current policy is. We recommend that to balance that longer time period and the fact that you're bringing in more complaints, as I mentioned, we were very concerned about political weaponization. And to balance that, we recommend that complaints be made under penalty of perjury. And that encountered some debate on our group. It was important to me in this respect that perjury means a knowing falsehood. It doesn't mean that you make a complaint that later turns out to not be supportable. It just means that you knew what you were doing. And we think that that's one way to combat the weaponization of complaints in the Capitol. We recommend that you remove the current prohibition in Rule 27 on discussing investigations. That prohibition runs afoul of a number of concerns. Some of them are free speech related. Others are, it is unclear whether or not the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act would apply in this instance or not, given the broad range of control that a legislature has to govern itself. Nonetheless, the principles of the PECPA and the related federal National Labor Relations Act all say that employees should be free to discuss the terms and conditions of their employment. We think that that's a best practice. We think it's quite possible that this prohibition does apply to the legislature. But whether it does or not, we think that telling people that they can't discuss things that have happened to them is wrong for a number of those policy reasons I've just mentioned. We believe that you should remove human resources and the legislative council mostly from this process, and that you should also remove their ability existing in the current rule to correct findings of an investigator. We believe that that would be one way for, not that the folks in the current roles are not wonderful, they are wonderful, but that would be one way to cause, to create a stain, perhaps, on the investigator's report. It would be one way to damage the fact that if you have a neutral and independent investigator, you don't want someone coming in and telling them what they can and cannot find. This is a new recommendation. We recommend that you institute a method for interim safety measures, for measures that can be taken to protect a complainant and actually to protect a respondent during the course of an investigation. This is a very common practice in sexual harassment and racial harassment law generally, and it stems from the fact that an employer has an obligation, once they know that harassment may be occurring, to put a stop to the harassment. So if you're in that interim period where you're not sure if harassment is occurring, you still need to take steps to make sure that it's not happening until you have it figured out. So we recommend that you do that. We recommend that you expand the remedies to respond to findings of harassment. We've listed what those remedies might be. One concern that folks raised in doing this is that creating remedies such as fines or informing employers or exclusion from a building for someone like a lobbyist, it could have free speech implications. We're aware of that. The constitutional lawyers on the group, including myself, discussed this, and we believe that the policy would be facially constitutional. The issue would be how one would apply it. And it would be very important to make sure that when you are applying any of these remedies, that you're not interfering with folks' fundamental rights, either rights to free speech, rights to assemble, to petition the legislature for redress of grievances, or the right to due process. So the application of this will be very important, but the mechanism of having a remedy is not by itself unconstitutional, in my view. We believe that you should provide more transparency to a complainant and respondent to understand what part of the investigation the investigator is currently on, how long the investigation will take, why it's taking so long, and if it goes beyond a certain limit, we recommend that the investigator contact the complainant and the respondent, tell them why it's taking so long, and tell them when they think it will be done. We also recommend, and we have recommendations that I won't go in detail in, about how to strike a thoughtful balance between privacy during an investigation and public disclosure. This is the people's house. People have a right to know what's going on here. On the other hand, there are parts, particularly during the investigation itself, when privacy might be valuable. And we recommend that you strike a thoughtful balance between a prompt investigation and a thorough investigation. Not everyone agrees from the public feedback we've received, not everyone agrees that the timelines that currently exist in the policy or the timelines that we have recommended are short enough. Everyone would like to have a prompt response to a complaint of harassment, but there is a balance between having due process and figuring things out thoroughly and doing it quickly. And finally, we discussed the mechanisms by which you should implement these things. These recommendations seem broad, and how to implement them could be a challenge. We've actually provided you with a work plan in Appendix B, which is before you, that shows the specific recommendations, the timelines by which we think that these recommendations should be accomplished, and the mechanisms that you should use to implement them. Those mechanisms include rules. As you know, the only way that a legislature can discipline other legislators or specify rules governing the Capitol is through a rule. And that is because the Oregon Constitution provides that this body has the right to control the rules of proceeding and the right, the ways to punish other legislators. So that leaves you with rules as being the way that you're going to accomplish most of this. There are some places that we've recommended statutory changes. For example, we recommend some statutory changes in public records laws and in the evidentiary privileges governing reports. And then there are some cases in which we've recommended that you consider a constitutional amendment. And that's because the Rules of Proceedings Clause and the Punishment Clause in the Oregon Constitution have not been very well interpreted or interpreted much at all. And much of our determining what we believe those things mean was by looking at what other states and the U.S. Congress have done in response to constitutional provisions that are very similar. So if one is to be absolutely sure that many of the things that you are doing are constitutional, a constitutional amendment would be required. I know I've gone on for a long time. I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Well, thank you. First, I'm going to take the privilege just to start off by thanking you for your chairing, and to the chair of the commission and to the staff. We put a very difficult task in front of you, gave you a very aggressive timeline. Very aggressive. And I would just, for the public, many of us are just now seeing the draft, and we thought since we were here this week, even though your meeting is next week, it was an opportunity to at least get a preview, so we really appreciate that. There's certainly a lot of work ahead of us, and to have this level of consensus and depth and direction for us is incredibly helpful. You've also offered to stay together and help us potentially draft rules. And I know I personally don't want to lose any momentum, so we might have to take you up on that. We could use the additional assistance, I'm sure. And I know the Senate President and I are in discussion about how to figure out which group, joint group, would be taking up these recommendations into the session, because we want to make, you know, progress on these topics. And so I just want to say thank you for the depth of the work, and it's really quite helpful. So thank you very much. Questions? Over there, please.
I want to also echo the thanks, I think Senator Winters would agree with me. The minority caucuses are fully supportive of the presiding officers in having independent review of our harassment laws, and I'm very grateful that you would chair it and work so hard. Normally, we're working for low pay, but I think you guys even worked for less, so thank you. One question I have, you know, part of, as you said, the culture is has to change. The interesting thing is we have an assembly of both House and Senate members that come from very different communities. My community, very rural, is very different than my colleagues to the left and to the right, very urban districts. We know by elections and discussions that the folks who send us here see the world very differently. So it stands to reason that the people that they send here see the world very differently. And one definition I just want to raise, because I'm going to be asked about it, is in attachment A under protected class, gender identity or expression, specifically in your example about someone referring to another, a staff person or by the wrong pronoun, is an example of harassment. If you have a legislator who believes because of his or her culture and views in this world that there are only two genders, is that legislator committing an act of harassment?
I think what I would first start with is to point out that the protections for gender identity are not something that we came up with out of whole cloth. They are embedded in Oregon statute. And so when we're talking about what behavior is harassing, here I'm falling back on my background as an employment lawyer representing management. I find that harassment, when you come up for a hostile, when you're talking about a hostile work environment, you are talking about a series of things that taken together, all together, end up affecting someone's ability to perform their job. And best practices in terms of a anti-harassment policy are to take steps to eradicate any piece of that, because we don't know what might happen in the aggregate. Mm-hmm. And so with that in mind, the definition that everyone in our group agreed with in terms of harassment was one that went beyond the legal standard. So it would take any piece of harassing, potentially harassing behavior, and it would make it part of what would be prohibited. And I think what I'd say in terms of the process of dead naming, which would be using a transgender person's former name, or using the wrong pronoun, is something that can make someone in their work environment feel unwelcome. And so we would want to take steps to change that. Now, does that mean that every single time that a person inadvertently uses the wrong pronoun, they're going to be brought up in front of a jury and whipped? No, of course not. But it means that we do have to take steps to make sure that all people in the Capitol feel welcome, and that includes maybe a process of letting folks know what the impact is on that individual when something, when a name that they don't perceive as their name is being used.
Just to follow up, I think this is an area that I know, because of the cultural differences, is going to, there are a lot of people who are going to ask and read this and ask questions, and I'm simply throwing it out there because I know it's coming. Mm-hmm. The examples used, for an example, the word that someone to denigrate, and someone who gives verbal or written material that denigrates. And I think there may need more, we may need more to help folks understand, because specifically, there are people in the world who do view that there are only two genders. And there are people in the world who view that there are not. And if that is going to be brought in, I'm just saying, colleagues, if that's going to be brought in, then I think we have to be aware that there has to be some illustration to be able to create a recognition so that someone knows when they're doing it. If the line is someone feels unwelcome, and I would sure hate for someone from Prineville to be, or from Paisley, to be deemed to have harassed by a standard that is from Northwest Portland. Does that make sense?
May I? Ms. Runkles Pearson, thank you. I feel free to jump in. I think this illustrates there's more conversations to have based on the recommendations. I do also know, I want to just point out the one comment you made earlier that culture change is more than rules and regulations and definitions and actions. I know many of us are looking forward to the training, new training we will have, and when we're here back in January, that will hopefully give us skills and tools as individuals to address, I think, some of the issues that Representative McLean is raising. And I think, you know, we have some work cut out for us. But I also know that we share a value, regardless, I think, of where you live in this state, of making sure people who come into this building feel like they can operate through their highest potential in the workplace and feel welcome. And I, you know, and this will take work to do. So, Ms. Pearson, Runkle Pearsons, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, thank you, Protect Representative McLean. I hear what you're saying, and I realize that that people in Oregon come from many different viewpoints and many different backgrounds. I spend a good deal of time in Baker, for example, with my family there. So I know what you're talking about. I don't think that it's the view of the committee, and certainly not of myself, that there should be some sort of draconian set of rules that are set up simply for the purpose of whacking somebody as soon as they step out of line. But I do think, as Co-Chair Kotek has stated, that these conversations are important, and that it's important to open a conversation about how to make everyone feel welcome and valued and part of this community, everyone, rather than having those people, transgender people, for example, sit in silence and simply feel unwelcome. So I think rather than bury this clash, I think it's important to bring it out into the open and to have discussions so that everyone knows that this can be a welcoming place for everybody. And I think most of that, as Co-Chair Kotek is saying, does come from the training portion of our recommendations rather than the enforcement portion of the recommendations.
Sure. You know, thank you. And I'm, you know, political conservatives, I sued a school on behalf of a kid who was expelled for wearing a T-shirt. And so, you know, what I hope, I fully agree with the goals. And what I hope is there's recognition that as we get there, colleagues, you know, that that we aren't chilling free speech and expression. In one of the definitions, and since you referred us there, I looked at under attachment A, does give when you have written material that denigrates a protected class. And so I just flag that because it's here that you could have legislators or other people who in their writing giving political expression, giving expression to their free speech, if it's perceived to have denigrated someone in the building, then we have competing values. And I don't think, I guess, you know, free speech is something I highly value. So that's why I'm sensitive about it. As a libertarian, when we have a definition that says written material that denigrates a protected class, I can see where a political conservative could be in a written way, whether it's a post on Facebook or it's an op-ed to the paper. And I use the one example to me that is prevalent right now, and that is how many genders there are. And so if you said the line is someone feels unwelcome, then you could, I mean, if a staff member from Portland working for Representative Williamson reads an op-ed written by somebody and they're expressing a political opinion, and that perhaps denigrates, then they feel they're a protected class, you could have a conflict. When that conflict occurs, what do you, is there anything in here to, that you're suggesting that we navigate as to, you know, which wins? Or are you simply saying that it, the conversation is a process by which mutual understanding is achieved, and hopefully that settles a dispute?
Chair Kotek, Representative McLean, I think that there are a number of pieces of this that will assist. First of all, I want to let you know I share your concerns about free speech, and so did every member of our work group, and free speech was discussed at great length. And that goes to the remarks I made earlier that while it's very important that we have these rules, they need to be applied in a method that doesn't harm free speech. I think that, and this is not a recommendation of the work group, this is my own view, and it's informed by representing public bodies dealing with free speech concerns with exactly this kind of clash that you're talking about. I think that the conversation does help a great deal, and that there is a big difference between someone writing an op-ed about their particular feelings about a political matter and using a term to a person's face that harms that person. So while it's not really possible in our recommendations to suss out every situation, I think we were cognizant of the kinds of free speech concerns that you're talking about. And I think that that's something that will need to evolve in the building over time.
Thank you.
Yes.
So first, I want to thank you for the work that's being done and the recommendation, recognizing that this is draft and not final. But there's been a lot of good work here. And recognizing that we still have more work to do as a body. I appreciate very much of it being all-inclusive, and I need to put that on record because it's not just talking about one group. And I really appreciate that because when we talk about changing culture, and that really culture change will require an awful lot of education. To do, and it's my hope that we just don't have one introduction and leave it at that, and then we think that we have completed the work and the task. And so, but I really want to commend you and those who worked on this of the work that's being done that has been done, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to echo the positive comments that have been made about your work. I particularly appreciate your emphasis on creating a balance and going beyond the statutory, you know, process issues to the overall issue of culture. That's a very hard thing to deal with, but that's really the nut of it. And also your understanding of the generational issues. We all know about diversity in any number of ways, but I think the generational issue in this subject area is really important. And I particularly like the constant reference to the word welcome, because that puts the discussion in the line of the person who is not at the top of the heap in the power structure. And that's really what we need to be thinking about, is how behavior is affecting the person who is not in the higher end of the power structure. That really gets to the essence of what we're trying to accomplish here, so that everyone, regardless of where they are in the power structure, can produce to their highest and best without feeling diminished in any way. I did have one specific question, and that is on the area of confidentiality. There were some concerns that came to my attention about the current language in our rule, which you referenced, that requires confidentiality among participants during an investigation. And I'm wondering if that's something that we should address right away, because we will be considering our Senate rules, which reference Rule 27, whether that's something we could address right away instead of waiting for the already aggressive timeline that you're operating under. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Co-Chair Kotek, Senator Burdick, thank you. And yes, I do think that that is an easy fix. I think it would be simply a matter of deleting something. One other possibly easy fix would be changing the timeline by which someone can bring complaints.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Smith, and then Leader Williamson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you so much for being here. This is good work, really good work. Thank you to the committee and everyone who participated. I'm not an attorney, but I did have a simple question related to the law. Did the work group at any point in time have a conversation about Oregon's current harassment law and how that would play out as it relates to this recommendation? And should we be looking at Oregon's current harassment law to broaden it even further?
Representative Smith, no, we didn't discuss statutory changes to the current Oregon employment law. To be clear, the law that we think applies here is not only the employment law, but also the public accommodations law. And both of those are fairly broad in terms of classes of people that you're talking about. I think it's important to note that we were very focused on this as employers or workplaces or public accommodations internal policy rather than the external policy. So no matter what we do here, employees here would still have the opportunity, you know, at some later date to bring a lawsuit. But we weren't concerning ourselves with the details of how one would bring a lawsuit. We were more concerned about how an employer should deal with things internally. So to briefly answer your question, we didn't consider changes to the harassment law.
Can I just quickly follow up? And thank you, Madam Speaker. What I'm trying to wrap my arms around is if someone committed an act sufficient enough to lose their job or lose access to this building, under Oregon's law, wouldn't they also be subject to a Class B misdemeanor and therefore committing a crime?
Co-Chair Kotek, Representative Smith, we didn't look at the criminal law, and I'm personally not a criminal lawyer, so I can't make that, I can't answer that question.
And again, I'm going down a path I don't know. I'm just trying to make a correlation between the law mm-hmm. and policy and say, shouldn't there be some form of overlap? Just a thought.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I, like all the members on this committee, echo thanks and appreciation for everyone who works so hard on this process. I just wanted to call out the recommendation on the evidentiary privilege. Having worked on that campus sexual assault bill, we have seen reports go up, and it has had a really positive effect on people coming forward and getting resources when they may not be ready to tell their story. And I think the recognition that a person's ability to tell their own story when they're ready to do it is important, and making sure that our rules recognize and facilitate people who do want to come forward and those who want resources and who aren't ready to be public. So I really appreciate that piece.
Any other comments?
Senator Maz Anderson, and then I'll conclude.
Just a comment. Again, thank you. Being a class, meaning I'm old, I have just what this legislature has done so far with some of the events that have happened here in this building. I, as a person, have really, really view things entirely different. I now view sexual harassment differently. I view harassment, just general harassment, differently. And so part of this, as it is a generational thing, is extremely important for every one of us. I represent, what do we represent? A senator represents 150,000 people, something like that. And in that process, we're exposed to so many different types of people, and we need to have respect for all of them, whether they, you know, agree with me or not. But still, having this type of document, reading this information, is an educational process for every legislator, and it's extremely important for us anyway as legislators to take this very seriously and to own this document. So thank you for that.
Chair Runkles Pearson, have anxiously awaited your research. As the speaker said in her very thoughtful opening statement upon completion of your presentation today, it was the speaker and myself that asked you to take on this extraordinarily difficult situation. It's noted in your report on page one, both of our names, asking you to please help us find a path to deal with this issue. And you, I want to say, counsel, in your opening remarks, for me, I don't think I've ever heard a more profound, remarkable statement about power, harassment, workplace than what you presented here today earlier. And I want to say I know a little bit about legal research, and we asked you and the other men and women with you on that law commission, all volunteers, to, and we did it last spring, we asked you to use your words, we asked you to be prompt, because that's prompt. Believe me, when you ask for this kind of legal research to be done by the next legislative session, less than a year, but at the same time to be thorough, to use your word from thorough, and that is what you have done, is remarkable. And I really feel that we desperately needed your work and your efforts. The legislature needs it. But I also think the people of Oregon need it, because the credibility you bring to this when you consider who you are and who you serve with is incredible. As a lawyer and as a state legislator, I am very, very grateful. I mean it, for your willingness to even come here today, but for you to come up with this effort before the next session starts. I'm very grateful. Many of your words, I am thinking, they're ringing in my head as a lawyer and as a public policy maker. So I thank you. And I gotta tell you, it's been in the spotlight on this issue, that's all I'm gonna say. I think the speaker has also spoken. We need help, and you have helped us. And you've helped the legislature, and you've helped Oregon. And I hope you will take that back to the men and women who've served with you on this law commission, as well as the staff, as well as the staff. Job well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And as you can see, the chair of the Oregon Law Commission is here, as is the director of the Law Commission, and the very able staffer that you provided us with, without whom we could not have accomplished this project. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity. This is one of the more interesting projects that I've ever had the opportunity to work on, and to work on it in company of so many bright and dedicated people has truly been a pleasure. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And like I said earlier, we will probably seek your advice going forward. We will have opportunities to dig into various aspects of your recommendations and probably will need additional assistance. So I'm sure you will hear from us.
We will stand at the ready. Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on this matter. Thank you all. I see we're at noon, but we do have other items, so I'm going to open public hearing on the adoption of personnel rules. We have some items that are on OLIS that are somewhat housekeeping in nature, and I believe Legislative Council and Employee Services, Dexter and Lori, I think, are making a presentation for us.
Co-Chair Kotek, Co-Chair Courtney, members, good afternoon now. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and with me is Laura Christopher from Employee Services. And we will talk about the technical changes to the personnel rules that are before you, basically a very high level, but feel free to, we can answer questions if you have them, if you want to deep into this, delve into this deeper. To begin with, there are five categories of changes here, and the first of these changes, it's been mentioned by you, Co-Chair Kotek, before. The first is allowing, changes the rule to allow the presiding officers to adopt a different approach to modifying these personnel rules than bringing them before a legislative administration committee, and that is a change in Rule 1. So it would allow you to form a or assign proposed changes to a different joint committee, and would also allow proposed changes to be done in the form of concurrent resolution, so that it could be set forth in OLIS, amended in the proposed amendments in the usual fashion, and it would increase the transparency of proposed changes.
And may I just comment on that? Excuse me. So, and granted, I would assume not any of us have had a lot of time to think about this. So here's the purpose for this. We normally do personnel rules in legislative admin. We also have standing committees as we go into the session that, for our calendar, might be a better place with a bigger committee and more time than, say, this committee allows us to do with our other commitments. The idea of perhaps a already set of standing committees meeting jointly to address some of these things, this would allow us the flexibility to do that. That's the purpose of it. So LAC, which this committee doesn't normally have a scheduled time during session. It's very hard to schedule, and we sometimes don't have a lot of time. We're thinking if we have the opportunity to have a more public vetting and a standing committee already out there, we might do that. We haven't decided that yet, but we'd like that flexibility, hence the rule change. Yeah.
The second change is very housekeeping. You see that also in Rule 1, but it runs throughout the rules, and that is simply to add LPRO, Legislative Policy and Research Office, to the list of legislative service agencies otherwise referenced in the rules. The third change are primarily changes to Rule 4 to implement 2017 House Bill 2005. That's the Equal Pay Act. And the proposed changes to Rule 4 basically dovetail changes in that law by first limiting the use of salary history in fixing compensation, and second, directing that pay be in conformance with an equal pay analysis that complies with the law and in terms of both content and timing. The fourth basket of changes are, well, a little history on these. In the fall of 2017, legislative leadership asked the Bureau of Labor and Industries to take a look at rules and give recommendations on them. In March of 2018, the Bureau's Technical Assistance Division did so and provided those changes, and the changes are reflected. I'm not going to go into detail here, but you see them in changes to Rule 6, recruitment, Rule 15, family and medical leave, Rule 16, sick leave, and Rule 28, safe and healthy workplace. That brings us to the last category of changes to the rules, two requested by Employee Services. First, to allow more time for Employee Services to complete reclassification and salary studies. That is the change in Rule 3.6. And finally, change in Rule 15 to modify how Federal Family and Medical Leave Act and Oregon Family Leave Act balances are computed to convert them from a rolling 12-month basis to a calendar year basis. That is a very brief summary of the changes. I will touch base just a little bit more on the forum of LAC as the how these changes are made. As a legal matter, LAC only has the authority to propose changes for legislative administration employees, and it is the reference in House and Senate rules, kind of, there's a reference in those that adopt changes and apply them to members, partisan staff, and the other nonpartisan service agencies. So none of these rules are going to go into effect until chamber rules are adopted in the 2019 organizational session. That also means that there is additional opportunity if you want changes to these rules before then. There is opportunity to implement those changes. That concludes my remarks, Lori.
Nothing else.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Again, I understand many of you didn't have a lot of time to review these. So questions?
Are we voting on these?
The hope is to just these. There are certainly other things we might take up next year or between now and when we vote on chamber rules, but just these today, yes.
Okay, then a question about Rule 1.3. Dexter, is the amendment the effective date of the rule change or the notice in order to change the rule?
Co-Chair Kotek, Representative McLean, the question, your question is, when is this change go into effect?
Correct. And then subsequent to that, how many days notice in order to change the rule? Because currently it's a 30-day notice, correct?
Currently is a 30-day notice, and one of these changes would eliminate the 30-day notice.
All right, well then my follow-up is, so this has been on a list for 2 days, and then we want to eliminate the 30-day notice. So, Madam Speaker, I'm gonna vote no today because I can't eliminate a 30-day notice when this has only been public for 2 days.
Yeah, if I may follow up, Representative McLean, there will be a motion that will back this up, that this rule actually does not go into effect until chamber rules are adopted, which is actually 31 days from today, I believe.
Comforting.
Representative McLean, can you clarify your concern for me? I'm sorry.
Well, my concern is just that I think just a
general principle that if you eliminate a 30-day notice before you can change a rule, and it's only been public for 2 days, the proposed amendment, that we should not vote on it until it's been public 30 days. As a general principle, I think that's consistent. The fact that it's not going to be effective for 31 days may be comforting, but still, generally speaking, we're being asked to vote today after 2 days of notice to amend a 30-day notice requirement before a rule can be amended. And that's troubling. Awkward, I know, but these things are process issues, and process issues matter to me.
Before you answer that, maybe question. Thank you for raising this. Why are we eliminating the 30 days before the effective date of the change?
The
because here's what I heard is that even these won't go into effect until we basically affirm them through the chamber rules on opening day, which is 14th of January?
Mm-hmm. 14th of January.
So, I mean, we're meeting the 30-day before implementation, so I get to your point. I guess I'm not totally clear why we are deleting A. Is there a particular reason for that?
Madam Co-Chair, the reason is that in the past, this has been something that I'm not sure has been actually followed in LAC proceedings. I'm not sure that proposed rules have been published 30 days in advance.
Well, perhaps not for consideration, but I don't believe they've ever gone into effect right away, have they? I'm trying to remember in recent changes.
Well,
I could be wrong on that, but.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, you can look at the change in the applicability date at the end of each rule. I think that the earlier one would have gone into effect shortly before the even year session. So I'm not sure that was complied with, to be candid.
So, again, I think part of the reason we have some of these changes is we have been in consultation with Bowley, for example, on some of these changes. There's a variety of things. We've talked about them all. We have flexibility to make other changes. I guess my question, Legislative Council, is if we don't do these today, is there some major problem?
Madam Co-Chair, no. These are technical changes. The one thing you may want to consider is if you want to propose this alternative venue rather than legislative administration.
But we would have the option to. Well, we haven't made our appointments yet, so we should take that under advisement if that is a barrier or not. But can we stand at ease a moment, colleagues? Do you mind if we just stand at ease for a moment?
Well, I was gonna make a comment.
Can we just stand at ease a moment? Get back to order here. Thank you for the few moments to discuss. We are still in a public hearing, and I think while these are technical changes, I think you see some consternation about kind of like the process of approving these today. So, currently we're just under public hearing right now. Anything more on the presentation on the rules? Because I do believe, I want to see if anyone else has public testimony before we close the public hearing on these particular rule changes or any, as it relates to personnel rules. Anything else?
Madam Chair, not for me.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So thank you for the presentation on these changes. We are still in a public hearing on adoption of personnel rules. Does anybody wish to testify?
Wait a minute. Somebody wants to testify, right? Please come forward.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Karen
Kotek and Chair Courtney, members of the committee. For the record, I am Laura Hansen, and I'm the new Chief of Staff for Senator Gelser.
Welcome.
Day five. She asked me to come today to draw your attention to a letter she has offered requesting modest changes to Personnel Rule 27. Senator Gelser supports the idea of a broader discussion about the rule during the session when there is time for complete and comprehensive hearings. However, she is concerned about readopting Personnel Rule 27 if it still contains a restrictive one-year time limit for filing a complaint and the unlawful language restricting the speech of individuals who believe they have experienced harassment. She recommends deleting the unlawful language regarding confidentiality and temporarily changing the timeline for filing a complaint to 4 years. Her letter addresses these issues in more detail. Senator Gelser asked me to express her thanks and appreciation to all of you for your work to improve the climate of the Capitol. She especially appreciates the presiding officer's decision to charge the Law Commission with bringing recommendations back to the body. And she asked me to offer particular thanks to Betsy Einholt and Tim Inman, who are not only coordinating much of this work, but are also going above and beyond to support individuals who have concerns about these matters. Thank you for your time and consideration of these modest changes prior to the adoption of chamber rules on organizational days.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for the material. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any other public testimony for the hearing today? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing. And with that, if there's no other business, we will not take up a work session on the rule changes at the moment. And we will be back in touch with how we're going to proceed. Colleagues, any other questions? If not, Legislative Administration Committee, before adjourning, I want to thank good Representative Phil Barnhart for his long years of service, not only in this committee, but other places. Thank you. You look at all the fun you have on your last day. So
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. With that, we are adjourned.